Country House podcast. Today we are discussing Their Majesties King Charles and Queen Camilla's private country residence, Highgrove House. It's a beautiful Georgian with neoclassical additions onto it that we'll get into later. But Jeff, it was actually your idea for us to talk about this house today, and I wanted to know why this one today.
Yeah, it's a good question, Ben. I think, you know, we've done private houses, but there are so many private houses that, of course, belong to the royal family. You know, there's not just the houses that are owned by the state, like Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle, and, you know, there's also the private houses like Sandringham and Balmoral. And then there's the country residences. So you've got Bagshot Park, where the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh live. You've got Gatcombe Park, where the Princess Royal lives. And only 6 miles from Gatcombe is Highgrove, where the King lives. And I think, you know, the King's been in the news at the moment because of his cancer diagnosis. And I thought it would be a good place to start because Highgrove has been a very happy place for him. And I think it's very relevant in today's climate to talk about Highgrove and also the projects he's done there, the gardens he's developed and the sustainability side of things that he's really worked on.
Connor, a good way to get into this might be for you to set the scene so that people can picture this as they listen.
Yes, thank you, Ben. Highgrove is very much like many country houses that you would see in outside a Cotswold village. It's almost cube square in its form. But what makes Highgrove so particularly special is it is the manifestation of the King's views on architecture, on gardening, and just how to treat the countryside and stewardship and all the values that he has spoken about for years. The entrance gate is understated and looks quite almost rustic in the sense that it is not manicured. The trees, the branches, canopy over the gate. But when you enter the gate, coming up the main drive, it bends through the parkland. And this is an 18th century parkland setting with fine specimens of trees. But since the King bought the house in the 1980s, or rather the Duchy of Cornwall bought the house rather than the King himself, the King has added fine specimens of trees to that landscape, and winding up this drive of crushed stone, you arrive at the house, which is 3 stories, 5 bays, and it's crowned by a pediment. This is the triangular cornice, in the center of which has a circular window. So it's what you might consider to be a postcard image of a country house. When people imagine a Jane Austen period drama, this is the type of house they envisage. But the garden is very much what Highgrove is all about. The house is a beautiful classical house, pilasters, the Ionic order, stone, a warm Cotswold colour. But this part of Gloucestershire is particularly flat, and so to add interest to the landscape and surrounding gardens, the King has created avenues both of trees and hedges, and these have matured over his ownership of the estate. And there's eye catchers and a mix of architectural items such as follies. There is rustic temples. I believe there's one temple made of bark from the trees. And in the tympanum, there are antlers. Am I right in that, Jeff? Do you know the temple I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. I believe you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's worth our listeners looking up the gardens of Highgrove. There have been books written about it where you can see images of the gardens. And I think we can get onto the gardens more in a minute. It's probably just worth saying, Connor, at this point, that of course the house that you've described hasn't always looked like it does now. And in fact, the gardens likewise. So I believe when King Charles, or Prince Charles as he was, bought the house in, I think, 1985, or the early 1980s, the house looked very different, and it sat within a park rather than an ornamental garden. And I'd love to chat more about maybe some of the things Charles did to the house over the years to make it what it is today. So just to explain to the listeners, Highgrove was much plainer when Prince Charles, as he was then, bought the house. He bought it from the Macmillan family, Maurice Macmillan, who was the son of the former Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. And he bought it in 1980, actually. It was bought not by the prince, but it was bought by the Duchy of Cornwall. So it's worth saying at this point, the house is actually belongs to the Duchy of Cornwall and therefore to the Duke of Cornwall, which means that the house now belongs to Prince William, who is the Duke of Cornwall. And it was in the news a few years ago that Prince William actually leases the house to his father, so that the king can maintain it as his country residence. But the house, when Charles bought it, was a very plain square box. You mentioned it's very typical of Cotswold houses, but it was I think it's 5 bays across, no pediment, no pilasters, no balustrading, I don't think either. All those things were added. And Conor, I'd love to hear more about what Charles did to it over the years to make it into the very pretty, classical, slightly Baroque looking house that it is today.
Well, pretty picturesque. We spoke in a previous episode about Henbury Hall, which was the new Palladian country house inspired by the work of Felix Kelly, the artist. He was also commissioned to envisage a picturesque version of Highgrove afterwards it was purchased. And it was his painting that led to the changes, which Peter Faulkner, the architect, he enacted onto the house. So in essence, you had this quite plain country house. It had pilasters in the Doric order. It had a parapet, but it was a flat top. It was a static skyline, so to speak. And to break up that skyline, to introduce some interest to the junction between sky and eaves, the architect introduced a balustrade with urns on top, and the urns, of course, are silhouetted against the sky. And then in the center point, you have the pediment. So this is bringing a central focus and emphasis to the center of the building, and it creates a stronger symmetry. And it is really just a picturesque, it's finishing off what was there. So in a way, when we see 18th century, the house, of course, was designed, built in the 1790s. And there is a print from the early 19th century that shows a Palladian window above the entrance door. Now, the Palladian window is an arched window with single pane windows either side. That was removed over the course of the life of the building. And when it in the 20th century, it was gutted by fire and the interior rebuilt.
Thanks, Connor. The remodeling that we saw in the 1980s with the addition, like you said, Connor, of the balustrading and pediment and pilasters, in many ways completed the house, I think, because like you said, the house was very blocky and sparse in the landscape before. It's worth saying that the architect they're not sure who the original architect was, but it's believed to have been Anthony Keck, who worked significantly in the Cotswolds. He built Barnsley Park, Flaxley Abbey. He has built Mockus Court in Herefordshire, which is in many ways like Highgrove is now, but in red brick. So Mockus Court is a Palladian house, a simple red brick house with a pediment and pilasters, very much almost a like Highgrove looks with the additions, Mockus Court looks like, but in red brick. So it's interesting. It must have been, I suspect it was an early work of Anthony Keck, because his style developed over time. Connor, do you want to tell us a little bit more about sort of the palette? So it's made of ashlar.
Yes, it's made of ashlar, so it's this warm sandstone colour. And in the landscape, when you have all these varying shades of green, it sits very comfortably and it has matured gracefully in that natural stone. But it's worth noting that the changes in the 1980s, like the garden, the changes to the house are very much in line with what the king has advocated for years, particularly in his book, The Vision of Britain, which I'd highly recommend you read. And essentially, the architecture of the house should be added on to sympathetically and in the tradition of the house, so that you can turn up and down the volume. In a way, you could say that if the architect in the 18th century were to complete the house, add more to it, it would look as it looks today. And what you see on the house, a trained eye would say that capital, that pediment was added in the 1980s, perhaps. But to most people, it looks like a typical Georgian country house.
How about the interior? It's something I haven't paid much attention to, but many of the specific country houses that we've covered, the interior is very opulent, very grand. Do we get that at all with Highgrove, or is that much more of a family feel inside?
I think you need to remember that Highgrove was bought in the 80s, so it doesn't have a collection that has been in situ for hundreds of years. So most of the houses we've talked about already in past episodes have been in the families for generations and generations, and they've accumulated their interior aesthetic gradually over time. Whereas when Charles bought Highgrove, he bought the house and then had to fill it. So he originally commissioned a very fashionable interior designer at the time, Dudley Poplack, who decorated it in sort of the fashionable take on the English country house look. So the English country house look was pioneered by Nancy Lancaster, an American lady, ironically, who married into the English aristocracy and sort of pioneered the sort of style known as the English country house look in the 50s, and that gradually developed over time. So you're talking sort of a lovely colorful palette, but not super bright, chintzy sort of floral curtains, silk curtains, fabrics, lampshades, and all that sort of stuff. And Dudley Poplack, I think in Poplack's obituary, it said that his take on Highgrove was a youthful variant of the chintzy country house look that was seen everywhere in the 1980s. So the palette was fresh, was lime greens and aquamarines. It was supposed to be cozy and family oriented, the sort of place where you could have dogs on the sofas and not worry about things getting a bit muddy, because it very much was it was a family home. It was where Charles and initially Diana brought up William and Harry, and then later Charles and William and Harry, and then with Camilla. So it's been a family home for 40 years now. And it was redecorated after King Charles married Camilla. It was redecorated by Robert Kime, who is arguably one of the greatest country house interior designers of recent generations. He passed away a year or two ago, but Robert Kime really was the most remarkable interior designer, who I believe has worked, I think he worked on Clarence House as well. But he very much tried to combine the country, the traditional country house look with well-placed antiques from different periods, lovely colors, dark reds and chintzes and sort of Moroccan colors as well. He was very good in chamoiserie and all these sorts of things. He combined them all very beautifully. And it's worth, if any of our listeners are in London, it's worth popping to Robert Kime's showroom on the Pimlico Road in Belgravia near Sloane Square, where you can get a really good taste of Robert Kime's style and get a feel for what perhaps Highgrove feels like now.
It is, you get the sense from the design, from the inside, from the garden of, and again, I feel like I say this with every home we discuss, but this one more so than many, of the family nature of it, you know, a family that's incredibly public, bearing in mind that Charles bought this just before the marriage with Diana. In fact, I learned that the swimming pool at Highgrove was a wedding gift for them from the armies, but it is very much this public family retreating to the countryside where Charles loves and the kids have a great time there. I got an insight into this when I was working for the country house painter Jonathan Miles Lee, who was close friends with Charles and Camilla and who visited there very often. And Charles commissioned Jonathan to do several paintings of the house, including a map of the gardens. And every time he would visit, I would so look forward to it because he'd send me rambling voice notes, you know, on WhatsApp when you see 10-minute voice notes or something. And I knew he had just come back from Charles and Camilla's. And there's so many fun stories then. He did a great accent impersonation of King Charles. But for example, one day he came back and he was visiting. He would often visit when the staff were away from the house. So it was just Charles and Camilla in the house. And Camilla often followed Jonathan on social media and had found out that one of his favorite meals was creamy mushroom bruschetta. And so lovingly and thoughtfully, she thought, I'll recreate this for Jonathan. And Jonathan laughed as he came back home from it, saying, it was just fried mushrooms on toast, but I appreciated the thought. But he would always come back saying, every time I visit, it's so warm, it's so inviting, it's so cozy and homely. And I love that about Highgrove. You feel it in the gardens when seeing the treehouse that was built for William's 7th birthday, I think, and all the rustic follies and the wildness of the garden. It really is a family home.
And it's probably worth remembering, there are so many stories one can read about how very much it was a family home. You know, there are stories of when William and Harry were in their teenage years and they used to go to the local pub and drink snake bite with their mates. Snake bite, for our listeners, is lager mixed with cider with a dash of blackcurrant cordial. And so there are fun stories of how very much it was a place where the royal family could, like you said, Ben, escape from the public eye and escape from public pressures and find downtime. And perhaps we could talk a little bit about the garden now, because when they bought the house was set in a park and there was very little formal gardens. And over the years, some of the most remarkable and renowned garden designers have worked on the garden to create a really beautiful series of rooms. So there's the wildflower meadows, there are the avenues that Connor mentioned. There's still a wider parkland setting, but the formal gardens surrounding the house are almost arts and crafts in their style of being split up into rooms with hedging and temples and follies and you know, the rose garden, the wildflower meadow and so forth. But just some of the names of the garden designers who worked in it. So the famous Molly Salisbury, Lady Salisbury, the Marchioness of Salisbury, who lived at Hatfield House, which we mentioned in past episodes. Molly Salisbury was a renowned garden designer, and she worked on the house in the early 2000s. Miriam Rothschild, another great botanist, worked on the gardens. And Rosemary Veery, who was probably the most famous garden designer of the late 20th century, who designed a very famous garden at Barnsley House near Cirencester, worked on the gardens as well. And then later, Julian and Isabel Bannerman, who are very well-known garden designers currently practicing. They worked at Astall Manor, the childhood home of the Mitford sisters. They make the most beautiful gardens. And I think they worked on one of the gardens, the Stumpery they worked on, and the Woodland Gardens. So in the gardens, like I said, there are rooms. So there's the wild garden, the formal garden, the kitchen garden. There's the carpet garden, which has there's a southern hemisphere garden, a walled garden, an autumn walk, a sundial garden, a woodland garden, and a Stumpery, which was created by the Bannermans in the 1990s. So it was very much pioneered in the early 20th century by people like Gertrude Jekyll and others, the idea of creating rooms within a garden. And it sort of helped to break down the space rather than having the stark contrast of the house and then the park. The house extended outside in a series of rooms, and the rooms would then open up into avenues, which would open up into the parkland. So it's sort of, if you Google map Highgrove, you can see how everything sort of splays away from the house, almost like a spider's web, with the house sitting at the center, these gardens that gradually open up from rooms into meadows, into park. And it's worth our listeners looking it up to see how that works, because it's very clever.
Yes, Jeff, in that meadow you mention, when they first moved into the house, this was also a meadow, but it's become a wildflower meadow through the king's approach to gardening and farming, which is organic. In the 80s, when fertilizers and pesticides and things like that were very much the convention, the king was going against that with his organic approach. And this what it really means is that he's feeding the soil rather than feeding the plant, so to speak. And in a wildflower meadow, now that's not feeding the soil. That's the soil doesn't have that many nutrients, and that's what leads to it. But there's so much color, insect life and wildlife in terms of bird species, songbirds there.
That's really a beautiful description of Charles's vision. And I think we can sum that up with one of his quotes. The king has described his efforts at gardening with the following quote. He said, "It has been one very small attempt to heal the appalling short-sighted damage done to the soil, the landscape, and our own souls. Some may not like it. Others may scoff that it is not in the real world, or it is merely an expensive indulgence. Whatever the case, my enduring hope is that those who visit the garden may find something to inspire, excite, fascinate, or soothe them." So he's taken a very holistic approach to the garden. And like you said, Connor, he's tried to rejuvenate the land, and that applies further afield, not just in the sense of the garden and the park, but his entire farming estate, because of course Highgrove sits at the centre of a substantial agricultural estate.
Yes, walking around that estate, you will hear the songbirds. Now, this is partially to do with gamekeeping and keeping the predation and the vermin species at bay, allowing the songbirds to flourish. But also the insect life is so abundant because the use of not only manure, but good compost techniques and using native species that, although there's ornamental plants that he has found from different parts of the world, by using native species of Gloucestershire and England, really, you will find insect life in abundance, which then leads to the perfect feeding ground for all sorts of birds. And walking around Highgrove, it's not just the color and the shades of green, but it's also the scent. There's lavender near the windows, so that in the summer months when the windows are open, you get this natural floral scent into the house. And also the songbirds, the variety of species, is a result of the decisions he made in the planting, the placement of the plants. And he's learned since the 1980s. He said he approached it as quite an amateur, but over the years, through guidance and friends and visiting other gardens, he incorporated his learning into Highgrove. And so visiting Highgrove, which it is open in the summer and highly recommend our listeners to visit, it will show you exactly what he has been talking about for all these years.
Yeah, and, you know, King Charles, with his public life, often finds himself exhausted at the end of the day. And you hear about the intention and his passions manifest in the gardens and the architecture. And it really is his haven, his anchor. He would often, despite having previously his London apartments, he would always try and return to Highgrove at the end of the day if he could, because it was rejuvenating for him. Connor, you explained earlier about why Highgrove, but is there any more information about the search for Highgrove, the houses that he may have looked for?
Yes, I think the search took a little while, actually, for Prince Charles to settle on Highgrove. We've talked about the many reasons why Highgrove makes so much sense. It's only 6 miles from Gatcombe Park, where the Princess Royal lives. It's nearer Wales, and being in Gloucestershire, it's nearer Wales and Cornwall than other parts of the country. And Charles was very much focused on being in that part of the country so that he could be near his duchy and his and Wales, where he was the prince of. So there were many reasons. He was initially supposed to have Cheveningham House in Kent, which is, of course, a government-owned property that is a beautiful classical house that is currently the country residence of the Foreign Secretary and has been a government building for many years. It used to be the residence of the Earl Stanhope. And Charles decided it was he didn't like the traffic getting into London from Kent. And also he decided he wanted to be nearer Cornwall and Wales. He looked at houses in Somerset and Dorset. I've talked about Chettle House, which is one of my favourite houses, an English Baroque house in Dorset. And rumour has it, he looked at Chettle amongst other houses. There was a big house in Somerset on the Duchy's estate that he looked at. But ultimately, he settled in Highgrove, and I think it's turned out to be perfect. What's interesting is it hasn't got expansive views. It's not high up on a ridge like many houses in the Cotswolds are. It's quite a flat setting, which, of course, has made it perfect for the creation of this garden with its separate rooms that span out into the wider parkland. But I think it's lovely to think of, I mean, there was a little cluster of royals around the Cirencester area in the 20th century. So there was Anne and the Princess Royal at Gatcombe Park. There was Prince Michael of Kent and Princess Michael of Kent at Netherlippy at Manor, which is not far away as well. And there are a lot of the royals' friends around there. The princes played polo at Cirencester Park, which was not far at all, so they could go for the day and get back to Highgrove for supper. There's a famous story, I love this story, where Prince William overtook a Land Rover, in his Land Rover, I think he was, or in his Golf, I can't quite remember, but he overtook an old man who was driving down the drive of Cirencester Park on his way to the polo match. And it turned out the old man was the Earl Bathurst who owned the estate. And he chased William down in his car and caused William to stop and berated him and said that it doesn't matter who he is. The park has strict rules of a 15 mile per hour speed limit or whatever, and this was back in William's teenage years. But it's quite a fun story of how these grand families, they're very no nonsense, a lot of them, and they're rules are rules, and you have to stick by them. It doesn't matter who you are, and I think that's probably quite refreshing for them. And I think that's one of the reasons why they wanted to live in a rural part of the country where people weren't necessarily sycophantic or treated them any differently. And certainly, of course, the Cotswolds is a very unspoilt part of Britain, with very pretty villages, gorgeous stone, and lovely country houses.
Yes, and mature woodland as well. So you have oak and chestnut, where you're surrounded by trees that are centuries old. But it's also neighbouring, to add on to what Jeff has mentioned, the Duke of Beaufort badminton, and the Duke of Beaufort's hounds, which the king would ride out with on a regular basis back in the 80s and 90s.
How is Highgrove then indicative of, and what King Charles has done to Highgrove, how is that indicative of his wider projects that we've seen with, I don't know if we'll ever talk about Poundbury because it's not a country house, but, we hear many things that King Charles has been doing the last several decades in the UK to champion various causes. And how is Highgrove indicative of those wider beliefs that King Charles has with regards to architecture, preservation, sustainability?
Well, Poundbury is worth noting that it's not too far. It's in the same part of the country, of course, as Highgrove. And then further southwest is Nansleydon, which is, I suppose, Poundbury part two in the sense of taking the ethos, the learning forward into Cornwall. And what Poundbury is an urban extension of Dorchester, built in natural materials in a classical style, and it's proved immensely popular. And just like the king's approach to gardening and farming, where the media and everyone else said he was wrong, and there were satires about his approaches, there were also people were against his approach to architecture. And just like the others, he's been proved that what he's building is not only beautiful, long-lasting, but it's ultimately what people want to live in. These are beautiful homes. And he's taken that on Highgrove in the additions he made in the 80s, and now in Pembury it continues.
I think it's worth noting that the King, he's always been passionate about architecture and classical architecture especially, but he's more than an amateur architectural historian. He has incredible knowledge. He's the president of the Georgian Group, or the patron, I think he was at least. I'm not sure if he still is. But he's had enormous influence in the architectural world. People can read about his, you know, he rarely meddles in things that might be controversial, but he has spoken out quite a lot about the modern architecture and how it's a blight on the landscape. He spoke out about Number 1 Poultry, which is a building in the city of London. And it was built in a very strange modern architectural style. And Charles was very critical of that openly and risking his own reputation. Likewise with Chelsea Barracks, he's put his reputation on the line because he cares so deeply about the built environment and creating beautiful, lasting buildings. And the late philosopher Sir Roger Scruton used to talk about how classical buildings, well, beautiful architecture full stop, is the most sustainable architecture because it lasts centuries. You know, you look at London, Georgian townhouses are the most eco-friendly houses possibly in the city because they were built 300 years ago. They're terraces, they share heat, they're tall, they're quite narrow, so there's a small footprint. The heat rises obviously through the house, and they're beautiful, and therefore they've lasted. Whereas you look at Barrett Homes or all these other modern developers, their house expectancy, the life expectancy of their houses are sometimes 40, 50 years, and that's it. So Charles has always taken a very long-term approach to the built environment. And you can see that at Highgrove, you can see that at Poundbury and Hansleyden and other places. But I think Highgrove has been a place where Charles has been able to explore and refine his views on architecture and his views on gardening and farming and all these other things. It's been a place where, you know, it is a family home, but it's also been a bit of an experiment for him where he could express his artistic interests.
To continue that, his views on gardening. So it's not just architecture that have impacted Pembury and Hansleyden. Also in gardening, in Hansleyden, there are, I believe, sparrow boxes. There are bricks that are specially designed to host nesting birds and species of native trees, which encourage insect life and bird life. So in both Pembury and Hansleyden, there is this combination of architecture and gardening and landscape all incorporated into it. Pembury is not a blight on the landscape. It is an addition. It is not to say that human habitation should be somehow an eyesore. That unspoiled landscape, I think it was Quinlan Terry who was always called the King's favorite architect. He said that an unspoiled landscape is not a landscape without buildings. It's a landscape without ugly buildings. And driving through the Cotswolds in the area of Gloucestershire around Highgrove, seeing houses, farmhouses in the countryside, they are absolutely an addition. They are part of that landscape. And Pembury continues that tradition as a beautiful skyline of, you have clay tile, you have slate, you have brick walls and stone walls, finials and chimneys, and it creates a beautiful skyline. And then you have the countryside. There's a clear division, a clear separation, I should say, between urban and countryside, a boundary. And this dense urban fabric meets the countryside rather than having a suburban sprawl. And Pembury, Highgrove is really the heart of all his ideas, and Pembury is where you see it manifest on a larger scale.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Connor. It's probably worth saying as we come to a close that, of course, Highgrove has both been a place where Charles could escape to and express his artistic interests and his architectural interests and his gardening interests. But also, you know, it is a family home, and it's a place where he's been able to pay tribute to people in his life who have made a significant had a significant influence on him. So we're not just talking about the people he brought in to help work on the house and the gardens, but in fact, in the garden itself, there's a collection of busts of people admired by the king. So people like Deborah Devonshire, the late Duchess of Devonshire, Miriam Rothschild, who was one of the garden designers who worked on the garden, and the recently retired Bishop of London, Richard Chartres, all people who the king admired greatly, and he's had busts of them. And Sir Roy Strong, interestingly, Sir Roy Strong, who Ben's got links to, I know, because Ben used to work for Jonathan Miles Lee, as he mentioned, and Jonathan was very close to Sir Roy Strong, but there's a bust of Sir Roy Strong in the Highgrove Garden because Sir Roy also worked on Highgrove and created his own beautiful garden in Herefordshire, the Lascot Garden. So it's lovely that you can go to Highgrove, and although we can't go into the house, and rightly so, it's the king's private country retreat, we can visit the gardens. I think the 30,000 visitors a year in the summer months visit, and you get a glimpse into the king's personal life, his interests, his passions, his loves, his cares. And it's a very touching and personal link to our monarch. And so much has been done about Highgrove, written about Highgrove, magazine articles and books. The Highgrove Florilegium is a 2-volume book that has 124 watercolors of plants from the garden, which is very interesting for our green fingered listeners. And of course, the Duchy Originals, which was the king's own range of organic produce that came from the Duchy estates and includes some things that have come from Highgrove. You can buy Duchy Originals at the farm shop or the tea room at Highgrove, and also indeed in Fortnum and Mason. So there are there's so much more to say about Highgrove, I think, or at least about royal residences and about the king, because he is such an influential person in this area, and he's such an advocate for the country house and for country life. But yeah, I would urge all our listeners to visit Highgrove if they can, or certainly pick up a book or a magazine article about it to get a better feel for this extraordinary place that he's created.
Absolutely. And thank you for that, Jeff. That's really helpful. And the busts on the Wall of Worthies, as you were mentioning, of people who have influenced him, they're great busts too. They're not as stately as you might expect. They're very personable, and I think it's a lovely touch. So thank you for joining us. And well, final piece of trivia, Elton John even contributed to the garden with his golden-leaved Indian bean tree that he gifted then Prince Charles on his 50th birthday. So much in there, and I haven't visited, but I'd love to visit at some point. But thank you all for listening, and goodbye for now.